You must picture me alone in that room at Maudlin night after night, feeling whenever my mind lifted even for a second from my work, the steady, unrelenting approach of him whom I so earnestly desired not to meet. That which I greatly feared had at last come upon me. In the Trinity term of 1929, I gave in and admitted that God was God and knelt and prayed, perhaps that night, the most dejected and reluctant convert in all England. Here we have our hero, C.S. Lewis, back at Oxford, becoming a Christian. But this is not your typical conversion story. And that's one of the reasons that we wanted to do this series on C.S. Lewis, is his life is anything if an ordinary Christian story that has had an extraordinary impact. I'm Cole Fakes. I'm joined by Ben Williams and Terry Fakes again here on the So We Speak podcast. And this is part two of C.S. Lewis, his life and his writings. And if you know anything about C.S. Lewis, you might know his writings. And if you get a little bit more in than that, you might know that he was a great popularizer of the Christian faith. But once you dive into his writings or the movie, The Most Reluctant Convert, what you realize is this conversion is so atypical that it's fascinating. And we left off last time with a dejected, disappointed romantic who had just gone through World War I. He'd had a very difficult upbringing. He was in love with beauty, but couldn't seem to find this joy anywhere that he looked. And so he's come back from the war. He's at Oxford. He's teaching at this point. But there are some deep rumblings in C.S. Lewis that will lead us back up to that quote. Ben, who was C.S. Lewis before his conversion, now that he's back at Oxford?
Last podcast, we read a little from Death in Battle, a poem by C.S. Lewis that really reflects his experience in World War I and a lot of the, I don't want to say depression, but the disappointment in Lewis with the world as he found it. He's a young man who had this imaginative internal life that's very lively. He's a romantic in the chivalrous sense of the word, not particularly romantic in the love affair sense of the word, but in the sense of, you know, knights and heroism, really, he's your guy. And yet World War I as an experience is the opposite of that. And so he comes back to Oxford and begins his work and reminds me a little bit in a different way, but a little bit of Peter after the resurrection in John's gospel, returning back to his fishing boats, trying to find something familiar to make sense of a very unfamiliar experience that was the death and resurrection of Jesus. For Lewis, it's the experience of the war, loss of friends and family and everything that had come before that. And so he just throws himself into his work. And he thinks that he will be safe among his beloved books. What could possibly bother him about his triple first in classics and medieval literature and the Green Knight and all the myths and stories he loved to read? That has to be the safest place in the world for a young man to hide. And instead, as he tells us later, those are precisely the tools that God used to track him down. You mentioned this is an atypical story of conversion. It might be a typical version of conversion, except it's not the way we usually tell it. We remember the singular moment, but what makes Lewis's story so fascinating is that he actually connects the dots that led up to that moment for us. And a lot of times we never do that. We never stop to think how many things had to work out the way they did, not to shove me over the edge, but to nudge me to the point where I was there. And in Lewis, he describes it in the famous chapter as a chess game, where he's just slowly being nudged in a certain direction. And at the expense of being off topic and talking theology for a minute, that seems to be the way God works. We just notice the flashier stuff. I'm reminded of Isaiah 45 when God says of Cyrus that I name him though he does not know me. I mean, that God's at work whether you know him or not. He's putting the pieces on the board, if we can use that metaphor, preparing for the moments that we'll recognize later as checkmate.
I think that's an important point that you make, Ben, about he comes back and he thinks he's going to find solace in his studies of myth and legend, and he'll find beauty there. He might even find joy there, perhaps, as he pursues that. And, you know, one of the things I think is encouraging for Christians is this idea that by pursuing what you love, you might very well find God at the end of that. But I don't think that happened by accident. What I'm hearing you say is that God was guiding, directing, or maybe another way we like to say it, pursuing him through this process, and seems pretty patient with him through this process.
Yeah, I would absolutely say that, again, we're looking for that moment of passion and a change of mind, something instantaneous. But how many moments lead up to these long stories? God seems to love long stories. I mean, the Bible is this, you know, this epically long book. And I always wonder, why don't we just start in Matthew 27 and get to the good stuff? But it turns out all those pieces lead us where we're going and make sense of it all. And there's a lot of value for us personally of looking back and seeing what good was there, maybe I didn't even credit God with, that actually he used to lead me where I needed to be. With Lewis, it's definitely the myth and legend of old. Things we might dismiss out of hand as old paganism, he found in it kernels of things that led him towards what he would call the true myth, the way things have to be.
Yeah, one of the unique things about Lewis is he narrativizes and reflects on his own conversion with some distance. You know, Surprised by Joy, which is his spiritual autobiography, is written a full 25 years after his conversion takes place. And so you have this backward-looking ability for him to put all the pieces together and say, this, I didn't know it at the time. If you're looking at it forwards, you wouldn't necessarily know that this was the thing that was going to lead to conversion, but looking backwards, you can clearly see the path of pursuit that God was taking. I think the atypical part of it is I have never prayed with someone who is becoming a Christian, who's giving their life to Christ, who says something quite like what Lewis says. I'm becoming a Christian, but I really don't want to. I'm really reluctant here. I'm being dragged into this against my will. In fact, that person you might want to take back and say, hey, maybe we need to wait a little bit and see, you know, what's going on here. But he is so insistent that what was happening to him is something where he's almost being led by the hand. I think we need to give a little bit more credence to that in the way that we tell our own stories, is that God is really the author of our stories, but then we tell our stories like we're the authors and we were making all these choices and making things happen. Lewis has the humility to understand that God was essentially laying these things out in front of him and then, you know, enticing him to walk through them, and creates a very readable, enrapturing testimony.
It really does. And, you know, the idea of Lewis did not go, as we kind of stereotypically think, from unbeliever to Christian. He had a step in between. He actually went from unbeliever, or actually he believed in things he had to let go of, and he became a theist first. And I think it might be interesting to go into what got him from an unbeliever, an atheist, as he would have described himself in the early 1920s, to believing at least the basic that there is a God. What changed in his life? What were the influences that got him from point A to point B?
So he describes it in that chapter, that checkmate chapter, as a series of chess moves. And he does it, of course, it's fun to read as a chess fan myself, and it's Lewis, great storytelling. But he describes it in four or five steps, beginning with, okay, he's surrounded by these books. He's surrounded by people who share some some common strangeness with him, you know, the Tolkiens of the world. You know, we might think, who's God to send him? Well, send him an apostle. No, it's this odd guy who writes stories about elves and dwarves and stuff. You know, that's the guy that devout Roman Catholic is going to show up in Lewis's life and be an influence. And he starts with, he describes kind of a desert phase where all the things he had used to keep God out start being disappointments. The new look of philosophy, the modernistic worldview, or any of the other hats he had tried on, just leave him desolate. That there's more substance in the myths that he had been reading in books and the story they told than in modernity and the philosophies he was being offered to keep Christianity out, which is a wild concept because we just assume, you know, modernity way better than ancient paganism. And he said, yeah, paganism had at least a story to it, that the modern philosophy just left me a desert and he had to go somewhere next. Following the desert, he starts thinking about this topic of joy again, which of course is the title of the book and something we talked about a great deal on the last podcast. But the difference between joy and thinking about joy, that it's something we're hunting for, but we often are looking back at, that it was a reality in life, not an illusion, but it wasn't something that you could master through science or logic as such and make joy appear. It was a glimpse of something further in. And the places where he keeps finding these sparks of joy are in all the odd places. He's reading G.K. Chesterton's The Everlasting Man and reading Christian literature or myths that are not Christian, but that take the shape of Christian literature. Even things that kind of looked like Christianity provided more joy than the alternatives. It makes Christianity start to have some weight, some sensibility to it. He tells the story of an atheistic colleague who mentions to him in passing that the history behind the gospel was surprisingly good. And he's just dumbfounded. He wanted his friends to help give him a reason not to believe. So between friends and the books, they start ganging up on him. There's two lines that I especially like in this discussion that are very similar. Again, in this Checkmate chapter, he says, all the books were beginning to turn against me. he's feeling judged by what he's reading in the sense that the truest things he finds are the parts of it he should object against the most. And then later, while he's reading MacDonald and Chesterton, he says, really, a young atheist cannot guard his faith too carefully. Dangers lie in wait for him on every side. Just the frustration of reluctantly finding truth where he didn't want it, which culminates in the Checkmate move of he went from a desert to a philosophy he didn't want to like but did, and that philosophy demanding that there be a person. And that was the final move, that even as a philosophy, he could keep it at bay, but the philosophy had an intrusive person. When he talks about his reluctance, he talks about the last thing I wanted was someone intruding on my life. Now, there's something that we all can identify with, and that Christianity, I think what had always kept it at bay for him was not the intellectual concerns or the philosophy, it was the intrusiveness of the God behind Christianity. And when he could find no other place to go, at last he turns to that God and lets him intrude. And that seems to be the culmination of the theistic story. What else did you guys see in that part of the narrative that stood out to you?
For me, I agree with everything you said. It was interesting the way, in fact, at one point, I think he says that he felt like he was holding something at bay. Those are his words in Surprised by Joy. And he realized that he had a conscious choice to either keep the door closed or open the door. And I think that's a surprising moment of self-realization. Although, as Cole said, he has the benefit of looking back on his conversion.
I love the thread of Tolkien's influence in his life. Ben, as you mentioned, he's completely shocked and dumbfounded that this character is going to have such a huge impact on his life. He says in Surprised by Joy, friendship with Tolkien, he's talking about Tolkien here, marked the breakdown of two old prejudices. At my first coming into the world, his upbringing, I had been implicitly warned never to trust a papist. And in my first coming into the English faculty, I was explicitly warned never to trust a philologist. Tolkien was both. And he talks about they didn't actually get along that well at the beginning because they were almost too similar. And they had such strong opinions on what should be done in the literature courses that they were teaching. But they get into this ancient Norse language club together where they're translating and reading and talking about these ancient myths. And he kind of starts to love Tolkien because he's such a genius and they share so many things. And there's such a wonder in finding somebody who values the things that you value. And after Lewis becomes a theist, he's spending a lot more time with Tolkien. And there's an amazing moment. And Alistair McGrath actually has traced this out exactly when this was. This was on September 19th, 1931. Lewis has Tolkien and another guy named Hugo Dyson over. And after dinner, they decide to go on a walk. And if you go to Oxford in Magdalen College, there's a walk called Addison's Way. And they're walking along this path and they're talking to each other. And the wind comes up and it's blowing these leaves and they're finding it difficult to talk. So they retreat back to Lewis's rooms. And as they're talking to each other, Tolkien says something that just shatters Lewis. This is the moment that some things start to fall into place on that journey between theism and Christianity. Because part of the problem for Lewis was he felt caught between a rock and a hard place. He loved the beauty and the myth. Ben, as you were talking about, the books. But then he didn't see any overlap with that in Christianity. In fact, he remarks that his experience at that point was basically that beauty and Christianity had no real overlap. He says, Oriental imagery and style largely repelled me. And for the rest, Christianity was mainly associated for me with ugly architecture, ugly music, and bad poetry. So he's conflicted in figuring out how all these things that he really loves, the kind of desires of his heart, this joy theme, is ever going to coalesce with Christianity. Well, on this walk, they're talking, and Tolkien says something to the effect that Christianity is the true version of all these things that you love. It is the true myth. It actually is the kernel, the core of what you've been longing for, but it has the benefit of actually having happened. So McGrath puts this really well. He says, Lewis now realized that he did not have to declare that the great myth of the pagan age were totally false. They were echoes or anticipations of the full truth, which was made known only in and through the Christian faith. Christianity brings to fulfillment and completion imperfect and partial insights about reality scattered abroad in human culture.
Yes, I was reading another biographer, Harry Lee Poe, did a three-volume biography, and he observes the same thing. He says that Lewis decided that the pagan myths from all over the world involved God expressing himself through the minds of these pagan poets, speaking to their imaginations in the context of their setting. But with Christianity, this looked like God expressing himself in the flesh and living among us. Whereas the pagan myths contained faint glimpses of God, in Jesus, God showed himself without any blinders. And he concludes this, thus, the revelation of God in Jesus, as you said, Cole, is the true myth. to where all the others have a little snatch of truth in them. They're all echoes of the true myth, which is Christianity. We're not used to using that language, but I think that's a great way to describe how what Lewis got to.
It's a good reminder for those of us involved, which I hope is all of us, in Christian evangelism and persuasion. There's a tendency to start with a hard no. People tell you what they're about, and you say, no, it's Christianity. And in the Lewis story, it's yes, but, or yes, and, the conversion process affirmed the parts of what he believed that were already true. And then, yeah, there was some sifting of Lewis's ideas that had to take place, and not everything Lewis thought or believed was true, and not all of it ends up in his faith. But the affirmation of what was true in the world that he already believed was the great starting place for mm-hmm. the conversion process that followed. And for a lot of people, maybe that's art, maybe that's hard work and duty or family, that there's almost no one. I can't imagine anyone made in the image of God alive that has no glimmer of some piece of the truth of the universe that God has made apparent to them. A lot of our job is finding that and say, yes, that one, that's the one that leads us further in.
Yeah, I think that's a great distinction, because sometimes we're a little spooked to get into a topic like this, as if what Lewis would be saying is everything is true. You know, kind of that all the roads lead to the top of the mountain, all the myths are the same. Right. That's emphatically not what he's saying. Yeah. And Ben, to what you've pointed out, there's some spade work that needs to be done, because it's not that everything is true. It's that if you believe that God's put his image in every person and that he's created this world and it has his attributes in it, we should be able to see true things about God in all of our experiences and interactions with people and with the world and with knowledge. It's that all truth is God's truth. That doesn't mean everything is true and, you know, just believe whatever you want, but that actually, if we really believe that God is the originator and creator and sustainer, you should be able to see true things about him everywhere.
You know, as I think about this and as I was reading about his life, it reminded me a little bit of the Apostle Paul's approach. You know, when he went to the Jews, he began with Jewish scripture. And when he went to the Greeks, he began with their ideas. And you know, what they were longing for, or what little glimpse of truth they had, that's where Paul would start and take people forward. Lewis kind of had an influence like that. But Cole, you were talking to me about his friends, and it seemed like he had obviously a friend in Tolkien who appreciated myth as he did, but was a Christian. But then he had another friend with whom he was a friend, but he seemed like with Barfield, he constantly arguing with him. And talk a little bit about the influence of his friends on this journey.
Well, if you want to summarize his conversion as Ben did, an atheist cannot be too careful who his friends are and what books he reads. And that's really Lewis's story. It's the combination of those books and those friendships. He says in Surprised by Joy that what was surprising to him was he kept meeting these real flesh and blood Christians, people that actually believed this stuff when he was an atheist. And all the things that he had been running from, the things that he'd been trying to get out of his life, kept showing back up in these friends and in these conversations. And Barfield is one of those friends that it was God's chisel to Lewis to meet Barfield. This wasn't one of those friendships where they immediately got along and agreed on everything. This was what he describes as the second friend, who reads all the things that you do, but gets the exact opposite point out of them. Or, you know, somebody that shares all your interests, but approaches them from diametrically opposed positions. And two things that he says about Barfield that are instructive for his conversion is he says that Barfield shook out two things from his worldview that opened the door for conversion. And the first one ends up becoming something that Lewis writes about later that he's very famous for, which is called chronological snobbery. And so a lot of times Lewis is quoted about this. He loves old books. The fashion of the familiar and the new is not necessarily a guide to truth. We know that for Lewis, but he's chronicling how he came to the realization of chronological snobbery, and that was Owen Barfield's influence on his life. He says the Chronological snobbery is the uncritical acceptance of the intellectual climate common to our own age and the assumption that whatever has gone out of date is on that account discredited. And so Barfield drags him back to these ancient philosophies and ways of thinking. And then the second thing he does is he knocks out his modernist theory of knowledge. So he says, the positions we had hitherto held left no room for any satisfactory theory of knowledge. We had been, in the technical sense of the term, realists. That is, we accepted as rock bottom reality the universe revealed by the senses. This sounds very philosophical, and in some sense it is, but the practical explanation of this is he figured out that the stories that he'd been living by, the ways that he'd started to understand the universe, couldn't actually account for all the experiences that he was having in the universe. And so, Ben, this brings you back to some of the episodes that we've done on faith and science. The problem with the materialist worldview is not always that it's defeated by rational argument, which I think is possible. It's that after you live like a materialist for a while, you realize that it's too small a container to hold the universe that you live in. And so you have Lewis saying, I was a rationalist. I was a logic guy. I was a realist. I believed that the senses were primary. And then he's in love with all this romantic literature that talks about things that go beyond the senses into the soul, like beauty and wonder and goodness and truth and language and all of these things that are intangible. So he comes to the end of himself through the conversations with these friends, realizing that his worldview is not big enough for the world that he lives in.
Yes. And, you know, it seems to me that that movement, that's interesting in and of itself, but Cole, that could only get you, I think, to God. I'm not sure that gets you to Jesus. You know what I'm saying? Is that says, okay, there must then be a God. There must be a transcendent being or truth. But he took that in two steps, which a lot of us skip and go straight to Jesus. And so how, you know, I'm curious how he got from God to Jesus. How did that become personal? Because in some sense, theism, the belief in a God, is something you can hold at arm's length. It's a little bit philosophical, like theoretically there's a God. Whereas Jesus, you don't have the option to take Jesus philosophically. That has to be personal.
Yeah, in true Lewis fashion, the final chapter of his autobiography is titled The Beginning. That to him, all the way through to theism, was just the long prologue to his learning of Christianity. And I feel a little cheated because it's only a few pages that I too want to know more about how he gets to the Christianity part. He acknowledges that that's where he ended up, but where he wasn't at that point. That at that point, he says, I was only a theist. I knew nothing of the incarnation at that point in reality. And it could be, if you read that short section, that he doesn't say a lot about it because there was almost nothing to say in the philosophical persuasion element of it. It wasn't that he had some arguments that needed knocked down and then he became persuaded. He kind of just starts going to church. I mean, just he starts acting as though he believed. That's something he'll say in Mere Christianity about love. If you act like you love someone, you will presently come to love them. And I think he kind of came to faith in the same way. He got as far as theism. He said, well, I guess I'm going to have to pick something, and starts going through the motions of Christianity, and along the way finds that it makes a lot of, that he believed it. And I don't know if even he could tell you at what point exactly which part of it made sense to him. It just that he knew he had to give up and accept something, and Christianity found its way to him. I want to know more, but he leaves only that short chapter of, I started going to church and started saying prayers, and lo and behold, what I didn't believe came and found me.
Yeah, I think that's two of the interesting things about his conversion that are really instructive for us is he's a theist, but he immediately starts going to church. And the reason for that is because he, as you said, Ben, he thought he needed to commit to something. But it reminds me, as I'm reading that part of his life, it reminds me of the phrase, faith seeking understanding. He has some seed of faith. He's become a theist and he's become a convert, you know, to theism, but he's not doctrinally all there. We would not say that he's a Christian at this point, but he's willing to explore the little bit of faith that he does have, which coincides perfectly with some of the ways that Jesus talks about faith in the New Testament. He begins with a mustard seed, but he allows the mustard seed to grow. And one of the ways that he does that is by going to church. He never misses services on the weekdays, on Sundays. In fact, his colleagues are shocked when they start seeing him at church, because they're thinking, you know, this is Lewis, this guy is an atheist. And immediately they start to notice that his life is changing. And he comments on this in kind of a weird scenario. About a year and a half after he's become a theist, he talks about becoming a Christian. And in the book, Surprised by Joy, he says, now this part I'm a little fuzzier on. It's a little more recent, you know, which is a funny way of talking about it, since it's a year more recent, 25 years ago, than the conversion to theism. But this captures it. He says, I know very well when, but hardly how the final step was taken. I was driven to this zoo. He's going to this zoo and he's being driven because, you know, Lewis never drives. He's a Luddite. He's against driving. He's driven to the zoo one morning. And when we set out, I did not believe that Jesus Christ is the Son of God. And when we reached the zoo, I did. Yet I had not exactly spent the journey in thought nor in great emotion. So what do we make of that?
Wow. It's hard to know what to make of that, except that it's almost like, you know, the ground has been prepared, the fertilizer is there, the seed is there, and it's almost like your kids with the little science project, you know, they come home, you got a cup full of dirt, you put a seed in it, and you water it every day, and then all of a sudden, one morning, there's a little green something sticking out of the ground, and I think that that seems so sudden, but obviously there was all kinds of preparation that happened. And that was, I guess, if you want to call it a moment of conversion, but honestly, his was much more a process of conversion.
I can't remember if I told this story in the last podcast or not, but I sat in a missions class at Midwestern one day and had a missionary explain that sometimes conversion is kind of like Pop-Tarts. I mean, that when they're done, they just pop up and you say, there it is, and you know it's ready. He says, but sometimes it's making tea. And I can't tell you exactly when it stops being water and starts being tea, but at the other end, you're there. And right. And it just kind of happens. And with Lewis, he makes that reference to, I felt like I needed to fly my flag. You know, if I'm a theist, I better act like one. So I just start doing that. And really a good case on a more philosophical end of discussion of the marriage of action and ideas. That humans aren't just brains, there's a lot more to us than that. And so the conversion process, when Jesus says we love the Lord with our mind and our heart and our body and our soul, that all of that has to be converted, and it doesn't all happen at the same pace. His mind had kind of jumped ahead, and then his body caught up and went ahead, and he's going to church, and his mind hadn't caught up with going to church yet, but it got there, and all of it kind of came along for the ride.
That's true. You know, it's interesting as you think about that some people, your feelings get there first and your mind follows. But for others of us, and like Lewis, your mind gets there and the rest of you follows. And I do love the idea that there's not one way or one process. There's one end point, but there's not one process to the idea of conversion. I do remember reading him saying that by 1931, you know, we started this at 1919, right after World War I, but in 1931, he says he had moved from belief in God to belief in Christ. And so by that time, this movement had happened and it had become personal to him.
Not to stretch it too far or get too far ahead, but later in life, he does marry. And when he tells the story, the marriage is kind of, I don't know, we might call it a marriage of convenience, or it's something pro forma. It's something he does, and there's not a lot of emotion attached. And then sometimes later, he says, you know, I came to love her. I love the person I was married to. Whereas we usually think of it supposed to go the opposite direction. You fall in love and then you get married. He got married, then fell in love. And his relationship to Christ kind of seems the same way. I started going to church, and then, you know, I found out I like this Christ. He's pretty good, and starts following further in.
Yeah, this is one of many unconventional pieces of Lewis's life. He does approach things in a way that he's being pursued, and then he realizes that he falls in love. And whether it's conversion or joy later in his marriage, or Joy's boys that he comes to love later, which he never really was a kid guy, but then he takes great care of them. You know, there's a part of Lewis that is willing to just be taken along, to jump in, and then to see what happens. And certainly when you look back at his Christian life, you realize, wow, some amazing things happened. I mean, he became a completely revolutionary voice for Christianity. But that might lead you to believe that he had this radical or early or all-in kind of conversion. And what you see is actually it was God's process of honing and shaping and recreating him. That actually happens for everyone. It's just really obvious in C.S. Lewis's story.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. I wonder sometimes if Lewis is maybe a good example to us in the sense that he was led to his conversion more than driving toward it. And I think a lot of times we think we need to drive toward our goals in life. Maybe I'm generalizing a little too much, but I really do think that there's a sense in which, you know, like Lewis, maybe we can trust that God is leading this process and that we don't necessarily have to map it out. The other thing I wonder, and you guys may disagree with this and jump in if you do, but it seems to me that the nature of his conversion, as slow as it was, as thoughtful as it was, and the time it took, meant that in my mind, it was going to be hard to undo that conversion. It wasn't a momentary faith, and it wouldn't be a momentary or easy thing to undo.
You do wonder that when reading, especially Surprised by Joy, of different phases and intellectual fads he dabbled in, and mm-hmm. you think, well, will Christianity just be one of those? And it's not. I mean, it sticks in a way nothing else ever had. And I do think, yeah, I think you're right, that it's the process resulted, God's process resulted in a superior product that it really fashioned him exactly as he needed to be.
I want to bring us back circumspect all the way to the beginning of how we started the first episode and the way that Lewis starts Surprised by Joy with the pursuit of joy. And of course he does this because he knows he's writing this narrative of his conversion. And so when you get to the end of him becoming a theist and becoming a Christian, you circle back around and say, so did he find joy? What ended up happening with the joy theme in this story?
I think we're all forced to make this choice. Is joy imaginary or real? And what we do is we either say, okay, it's imaginary and I should grow out of it, and I put my nose into my job and I lean in and I accept suffering and misery and just say that's the way it is. And you say that's being very grown up and mature. Or you replace joy with a substitute like pleasure and assume that you've found it. Mm-hmm. Lewis accepted neither option. That joy, he said, joy is real, and I don't think I'm growing up by getting rid of it. I mean, that we look at Narnia and stuff and say it's very childlike, but it's so grown up and mature. He said, you know, that these things are reflections of something real. Joy is real, but neither is it these pleasures that satisfy us so little. But rather, he comes to this third option, that joy is an expression of something we're made for and longing for further on and further in, that we're supposed to be pursuing it, that you're not supposed to get a hold of it. You're supposed to walk towards it and be drawn towards it.
And the distinction there for Lewis is between joy as this longing for an experience, and then once you've had it, wanting it again, but not really being able to describe it. That's how he defines joy at the beginning of the book. But then at the end, what he says is he comes to realize that all the value of joy is actually in the object of the desire of joy. It's not in the longing itself, as he had thought before. It's in what the longing is eventually pointing to, which as a Christian is a central theme in coming to Christ, which is realizing that this is not just a intellectual exercise. This isn't just a fealty to the God of the universe. This is the satisfaction of the longing desires that we have as human beings. You know, as Augustine said, our hearts are restless until they find their rest in him. What Lewis finds is this restless joy that he had been thinking about, longing for, hoping to find. It wasn't the joy. It was what the appetite was desiring, which was Christ.
Exactly. And, you know, I think Lewis apprehended the real understanding of the New Testament idea of joy. If, as we go through the New Testament, I think particularly of Paul writing Philippians from jail, talking about, you know, that letter contains joy more than any other letter. It can't be circumstantial. It can't even be the, quote, pursuit of happiness. It has to reside in the object. And I think Lewis absolutely there discovered what the New Testament means by joy.
Well, if you've seen the Most Reluctant Convert movie, one of the things I loved about how they did that was they, in the movie, when C.S. Lewis becomes a Christian, and the pivotal point in the movie is something that Lewis actually doesn't comment on as being as significant as this ride to the zoo, but in his life ends up being a very, very important moment. At Christmas in 1931, he decides to take communion. He goes to a Christmas communion service, and he decides to take communion for the first time since he was a kid. And he doesn't realize it at the time, but his brother, Warnie, who's in Shanghai at this time, actually has a very similar return to faith and takes communion for the first time on Christmas 1931, the same day, thousands of miles apart. And their newfound faith together is actually going to be a very interesting part of C.S. Lewis's later life and the back and forth between the two of them. And in the movie, Lewis walks out of the church after this communion service and the snow begins to fall. And it's kind of the end of the story that he's now become a Christian. But what's ironic is in the book, Surprised by Joy, as Ben, you mentioned earlier, Lewis calls this just the beginning. So we leave C.S. Lewis in this episode at the end, in one sense, the end of his previous life. But we're going to pick Lewis back up at the new beginning of his life, after Christmas 1931, when C.S. Lewis is still not the C.S. Lewis that's a household name today. In fact, he's a new Christian focused on his career at Oxford, surrounded by these close Christian friends. And we're wondering, what is God going to do with C.S. Lewis? And we'll find out next time. Thanks for listening to the So We Speak podcast. If you like what you hear, go ahead and leave a comment, leave a review, email us, tell us what you like about it, tell us what you'd improve about it. Thanks to all you guys who are listening, and we'll see you next week on the So We Speak podcast.